This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the part of the program we call the Big Picture, the fun part of the program. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. This is going to be a special edition today, and this topic we're addressing will take up the entirety of the program rather than revolving around a series of different topics. The economy is in its ninth year of recovery. This is the third longest economic recovery on record. The stock market is also in one of its longest running bull markets since 2008. Valuations are at their second highest level that we've ever seen in history. And here, and also globally, central banks are raising interest rates, or just at least starting to raise interest rates. The Bank of England announced it could be next, following the Bank of Canada's recent rate hike. So now the question is, and this is what our topic is going to be today here on The Picture, are we in the final stages of this bull market and facing a two-minute warning, or could we actually go into overtime extending the economic recovery and what's been a record bull market?
You know, probably the best way to answer that, John, is as we've talked about here, the economy and bull markets go through different phases. Usually there's three phases or three waves up in a bull market with two corrective phases. In an economy, there's four phases. And so if we take a look at that, every business cycle goes through these four phases. And it's probably best to look at where we stand today. In phase one, which is what we saw happen at the beginning of the summer of 2009. We call that the recovery and reflation phase. If you can think back to what happened then, the Fed announced QE in March of that year. And by the summer, by June, the economy had completely come out of recession, was in the recovery. It's the reflationary period. The Fed had dropped interest rates down to zero, and that still wasn't doing anything. And so what they did, they got rid of mark-to-market accounting, and then they came in with quantitative easing. In fact, they would go through a series of quantitative easing, one, two, and three. So that's phase one. Phase two is the recovery phase, and that really began in earnest, I would say, in 2012. We saw real estate prices come back. The economy and the markets were going up double digits each year, and it's probably the most prosperous period of time, and it's probably the period of time, at least under President Obama, where we saw the highest growth rates. I think it was one year we averaged 2.6 or almost 2.8%, because this economic recovery has been anemic and has been known for barely being able to stay above 2%. Finally, we get to phase three, and that is when the economy is approaching a peak, inflation is heating up, central banks begin to raise interest rates, and this is where we think we are today. And finally, phase four is when the economy actually begins to contract, go into decline, and we end up going into a recession. So each phase is comprised of a direction that we see take place in growth, where growth picks up, inflation, where inflation picks up. And these economic phases also largely determine which asset class performs best in each stage.
Yeah, but I think we have to point out, Jim, this has been a little unusual, because when we had interest rates at zero, both stocks and bonds have done well. I need to make a little clarification here, because we did have a few hiccups back in 2011 and 2013. But other than that, this is somewhat unusual.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you take a look at, and typically in phase one, when the economy hits its trough, the Fed begins its reflation and government begins its reflation efforts. Think of Obama's fiscal spending program, $1 trillion of spending, the Fed QE1, $1.2 trillion of money printing. At this phase, growth is down, inflation is down. It's a time when bonds do well. If you were in bonds in late 2008, and also, let's say, 2009, you made money in bonds, But also in this phase, the yield curve is steepening. Now, when you get to phase two, when the economy is on the economic recovery, what do you see? You see growth begin to pick up, which is what we saw. Inflation is still down because we're still recovering from the downturn, especially with the financial disaster that we saw take place between 2007 and 2009. So inflation was trending low. Stocks do very well. And you can remember that when we began the reflationary efforts, you can think back of 2009, stocks ended up the year double digits, 2010. But what was really doing well during that period of time, the dollar was falling, the Fed was printing money, stocks were doing well, but also doing well was commodities, especially gold and silver. Well, gold and silver peaked out in 2011. And so, but since that period of time, since 2011, stocks have outperformed. Great performances in the stock market in 2012, 13, 14, 15. The stock market went nowhere. It was questionable whether we were going to head into recession. We had a lot of things. There was a global slowdown, but then global QE began to kick in Japan and also in Europe, with Europe's economy bouncing back. In phase three, growth is picking up, and what you usually see in this phase is inflation picking up. And we're going to talk about inflation here in a moment. But in this phase, this is where commodities start to outshine and pick up the pace and end up becoming the top performing sector. A lot of people thought we would see that last year when the price of oil doubled from 25 or 26 down to up to over 50, with oil being one of the best performing sectors leading us into the first quarter of this year. But then from that point, oil has been in steady decline along with inflation. We think this is about to reverse. Now, phase four is when you actually see the impact of all these Fed rate hikes. The economy goes into recession. Inflation is still rising, which is why the Fed has continued to raise interest rates, which lead us into that recession and eventually a bear market. In this phase, the best performing asset is cash.
Yeah, what you're seeing, I think, you know, we've sort of seen this play out with the ups and downs in the recovery, risk on, risk off, and we seem to be in the risk on trade right now.
Well, typically in the beginning of the recovery phase, you're still sort of defensive because you don't know if the economy is pulling out of a recession. And then also in the final phase, when the economy begins to contract, especially when the Fed is raising interest rates aggressively because inflation is heating up, that's also where you get defensive. Usually in phases two and three are the best phases for the stock market. As you get to the end of phase three, the rate of return on stocks tends to be less robust, although this year I think could be a stellar year if a couple events happen. But you're right, John, this has been an unusual recovery. We haven't seen the 3% and 4% economic growth rates that you typically see. Number two, you have not seen inflation heat up as you normally would in an economic recovery, especially towards the latter stages. If you think of the last economic recovery that began in 2002, we were up to 5% inflation rates, and that was why the Fed raised the Fed funds rate to over 5%. This time around, we're lucky if the Fed funds rate will get up to 1.75% or maybe 2% at the max. So this has been an unusual recovery and an unusual investment market in that same period of time. And we've had these kind of false starts, this on again, off again with economic growth rates, where the economy begins to weaken in the fourth quarter and the first quarter and then heats up in the second and third. So it's been unusual, this entire economic recovery along with the bull market.
So now if we place ourselves in phase three, are we looking at a 2-minute warning, or do you really suppose there are things out there right now, Jim, that either the Federal Reserve or the government could do to extend this recovery beyond 9 years, which would make it almost a record in and of itself?
Well, I mean, this is all going to depend on three things that we're going to be watching closely and we're going to be talking about here in a moment. What happens to inflation? Obviously, if inflation trends lower, it makes it more difficult for the Fed to raise interest rates. And a good example is when we did the show last week, the probability of the Fed raising interest rates in December was they had a probability of 28%. That nearly doubled this week to over 50%. What did we see this week? We saw an increase in the CPI to 0.4%. So inflation is going to determine this. If inflation begins to rise and pick up, the Fed will get more aggressive in its rate raising cycle, and how the Fed responds to that. Either they look at the rise in inflation as they did, let's say, last year with the price of oil, is the Fed has been talking about, they'll often talk about, if they think something's temporary, one-off events, which is why they've been describing low inflation. They attribute a lot of that, we'll get to shortly here, to one-off events like the decline in cell cost, the decline in energy, which we saw at the beginning of the year. And then, of course, another thing that could throw us into overtime versus two-minute warning would be tax cuts, because there's nothing more effective the government can do to put dollars into the economy than to cut taxes for businesses and for individuals, which is why if you turn on the nightly news or pick up a newspaper, the number one talk right now coming out of Washington, besides North Korea, and then, of course, the tragic terrorist attacks that took place on Friday in Paris and London, are basically tax cuts.
You know, Jim, I was thinking here, what are the factors that you're using to determine what phase of this business cycle that we're in?
A couple of things. It's not just one. There's a number of things to kind of gauge where you are in the business cycle. One of them is the output gap, which measures the economy operating at full capacity. And, you know, the one thing that's happened, it's been trending up, but it's not at what I would say at its end. And one indicator that we watch to sort of gauge that is capacity utilization. In other words, at what operating rate are factories operating in this economy, and that has been trending up. As the business cycle begins to advance, what you normally see is capacity utilization will continue to rise, pulling inflation up with it. As factories operate at closer to maximum capacity, labor is running tight, you're running into overtime shifts, material prices are rising, and inflation is beginning to rise. And I think one thing that is going to surprise, that could surprise this market heading into this fall, and something the markets are not anticipating, is a rise in inflation right now, which I believe is coming. And that's what we saw this week. We saw the CPI rise 0.4%. Gasoline prices are rising. That CPI rise was attributable to two factors. Gasoline prices, a lot of that had to do with the hurricanes that we saw, especially what happened with Harvey in Houston, and then also rising rents. Other two factors leading to rising inflation are rising oil prices and a falling dollar. And this is something that a trend that has continued since the beginning of the year is the dollar continues to fall against other major currencies. One of the reasons that is happening is global growth is picking up, which has more to do with why the dollar is falling versus, let's say, inflation at this point. And the consequences of that have two factors that are going to impact inflation. When the U.S. dollar falls, it pushes commodity prices up and it makes import prices more expensive, both of which drive up inflation. So we have capacity, utilization, and the dollar are the largest drivers of inflation outside of something I would say, John, like an extreme supply shock that we saw, for example, in 1973 with the oil embargo. We saw it play out to a lesser extent in 2011 with Fukushima and the Arab Spring, which drove oil prices to $110 a barrel on WTI, and I think Brent was in the 120s. So these things are things that you have to keep an eye on because they are going to bear out with rising inflation. For example, we began the beginning of the year with the dollar index at roughly 102. On this Friday, the dollar index is below 92. So the dollar has fallen 10% since the beginning of the year. What does that mean? It means commodities, whether you're looking at gold or oil, are denominated in dollars. That's the way we pay for commodities globally. So the dollar falls, that helps to raise the price of commodities. And so with the falling dollar, we already have inflation picking up, and we've seen that reflected in import prices.
But Jim, you know, oil's been going up for, well, it was going up most of the first quarter, down in the second, and now that we're in third, down in the beginning of the third quarter. Since that's heading downward, how would we tell the commodities are still going up?
Well, I mean, we're looking at a couple other commodities, too. You've heard our guest on the show comment on precious metals. We'll talk about that in a moment. But copper prices are up 18% this year. And now we're going to be watching oil very closely going forward, which we're going to get to in a minute. But the other thing that we're watching, John, is, and this is reflecting import prices and raw material prices, we're watching the prices paid component of the ISM surveys and the Fed surveys. Prices fell in the first quarter, a lot of that reflecting falling oil prices, but has been rising slowly since June when they bottomed at 55 at the ISM Manufacturing Index. Now they've risen from 55 to 62. We're seeing that same trend play out in the ISM non-manufacturing, which bottomed in May at 49. Now the prices paid component is almost at 58. So another factor is the pickup in along with prices, which you see towards the end of the business cycle, is wage growth. According to the recent NFIB survey of small business, indicates that rising cost of labor by far is one of the number one concerns of owners and operators. So on balance, what we're starting to see is the economy is trending up. Along with that, we're seeing capacity utilization, the amount or percentage of which factories are operating at full capacity, that is rising. We are seeing the dollar is falling. It's down 10% this year. Number four, the price components within the regional and the ISM surveys are also rising. All of this should push inflation rates higher in the months ahead. And that could be the one big surprise the markets aren't expecting right now. But you can't have the dollar fall by 10%. You can't have capacity utilization increase. And you can't have material prices start to rise without sooner or later, this is going to be reflected in some way or another in the inflation indexes, which we saw. Now, you know, 1 month does not make a trend, but what we are seeing since late spring and early summer, the prices paid component has been rising in both ISM surveys. We're also starting to see that prices are starting to rise, import prices, which would reflect the 10% drop in the dollar. So if these trends continue, we would look for commodity prices to strengthen and outperform other sectors of the market. So, you know, when you take this in whole and take a look at it, here's the other thing that we're looking at. If we look at commodity prices versus, let's say, where the stock market is, and this gets into what we see generally in phase three, where commodity prices tend to outperform stocks. If we look at where commodity prices are now versus stocks in general, commodities relative to stock prices are at their lowest level last seen since the year 2000. So if our assessment is right, that inflation begins to pick up, commodities and commodity related stocks should begin to outperform the stock market. We're seeing a pickup in energy stocks. We're seeing a pickup in the precious metal stocks and base material stocks. I mean, if you take a look at gold prices, we've gone from 1151 to 1329. So gold prices are up about 16% this year. That's being confirmed by silver, which is up 11% for the year. And we're also seeing that confirm in the recent uptick in the GDX, which are gold mining stocks. They're up close to 16%. So when it comes to metals, we're starting to see silver in the precious metal stocks continuing to confirm the upward movement that we've been seeing in the price of gold. So as we go forward, one of the things that you'd want to be, if you are moving into the precious metals sector, you would want to see the gold mining or the gold stocks and silver continue to, let's say, confirm the price or the rise in the price of gold.
Yeah, but oil is the one that keeps people scratching their heads. You know, it's sort of been struggling along here. At the beginning of the year, we thought we were off to the races. Let's face it, last year was one of the best performers. And beginning of the year with OPEC cuts, we thought, wow, it's going to be another great year. But after the first quarter, everything's sort of gone kaput. So what about that?
Well, when it comes to oil, the U.S. dollar is one of the most important macro drivers along with supply and demand. And if we look on the demand front, one driver is global demand. Year over year, oil consumption is up by 2.3 million barrels. That's up 2.4%. And recently, for 2017, the IEA just revised their growth estimates up to 1.6 million barrels a day. And John, let's play that clip from the IEA raising their estimates for demand this year in global oil consumption.
As far as oil demand overall is concerned, one of the key points we make in our report that we just published is that in 2017, global oil demand, that's the Asian economies as well as the Western economies, growth has been revised upwards. We're now seeing oil demand going up by 1.6 million barrels a day in 2017, which is pretty strong. And carrying forward into 2018, we see growth slightly lower, but not that much, and the data will change, of course, and growth in 18 of about 1.4 million barrels a day. So on the demand front, growth is pretty robust in Asia and indeed elsewhere.
That was the IEA on their oil demand forecast. So, Jim, other than that, what other issues?
Well, in addition to global demand, oil inventories continue to decline in the U.S. and are now shrinking globally. The IEA said as a result of output declines that we've seen coming from OPEC, stronger demand globally, global oil inventories are begin to finally rebalance. And if we take a look at, as the IEA pointed out, the OECD commercial stocks were unchanged in July at a little over 3 billion barrels when they normally increase. So it has to balance this balance that they've been talking about, balancing out this excess supply that we saw build up, that glut, especially after 2014 when OPEC decided to go all out and basically drive down the price of oil with the hopes of driving American shale producers into bankruptcy. And John, that didn't take place. So, you know, it's one of the things that we're starting to see consistent drawdowns of inventory. Now, here's another factor, and this is not only impacting us currently, but this is going to have a greater weight going forward in the years ahead, and that's CapEx spending by industry has fallen by almost less than half of what it was only a few years back, going back to 2014. And now, what that translates into is outside major global oil recession, we are looking at a severely constrained oil markets in the years ahead, because in the next several years, oil consumed today and produced has to be replaced. If you're an oil company, anytime you're a natural resource company, I don't care if you're producing oil, gold, or copper, whatever it is, the raw materials you sell today, you have to go out and find additional deposits, spend money, and that means CapEx spending. And CapEx spending, John, is down by 60%. So on the future, as we take a look at oil prices, there are four things that are happening. Number one, we're seeing economic growth is picking up globally. It's picking up in Europe. We saw it pick up here domestically in the U.S. to a 3% growth rate in the second quarter. It remains to be seen if we will remain at that pace in the third quarter, but it looks like we're pretty close to that. Number two, the U.S. dollar is weakening. The U.S. dollar is down 10% from the beginning of the year, and oil is priced in dollars. Number three, multi-year CapEx reductions, the greatest reduction in capital expenditures that we've seen in decades, is taking place since 2014. And number four, we're seeing supply imbalances begin to come into balance. In other words, inventories continue to shrink, and they're now seeing that take place globally.
What really amazed me was your conversation that I was listening to between you and Joe Dancy when you were talking about all of the changes in the oil industry. And it's amazing how we've virtually doubled U.S. oil production, largely due to technology. And the S&P earnings, as a matter of fact, are up due largely to energy. This is going mostly ignored. All these radical changes are not breaking surface in a lot of consciousness.
Well, you know, there's always a saying in the markets, markets tend to go into extremes, and I think that's what you've seen taking place in the energy sector. In my opinion, I think oil has bottomed, and bullish positioning that was basically put into place at the beginning of the year on the premise that OPEC was going to cut production. You had, if you looked at the commitment of traders, there was a very bullish bet that was put in place in the fourth quarter. It was in place in the first quarter. That has largely been unwound now, with the speculators now less than 50% on their long positions. In addition to that, we've seen a flow of funds reports coming out of Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. The energy sector has seen the most consistent selling by retail investors. It's seen continuous outflows since the beginning of June out of energy sector funds, and we've seen energy sector selling by retail. But another confirming sentiment indicator, one we follow as a contrary indicator, is energy is the most underweight asset class held by hedge funds globally. And one of the things that really struck me as a contrary indicator is he's called the oil god, but let's go to that clip by one of the big hedge fund managers who is known as the oil god in the business for his energy plays, was down 30% this year and closed out his energy hedge fund.
Andrew Hall shutting down his main fund after posting large losses in the first half of the year. That's according to a report by Bloomberg that recently hit the wires. We have put in a call and email into Hall's Astenbeck, but have not heard back yet. The report says his Astenbeck Master Commodities Fund 2 is said to have lost 30% in the year through June. Hall has found himself on the wrong side of the oil trade. He's consistently said that the bears were wrong and that oil would soon rally. Hall, of course, became well known 9 years ago when he was given a $100 million bonus as a star at Citi. His nickname soon became the oil god, but his compensation drew attention from lawmakers during the financial crisis, causing Citi to sell its energy trading operation to Occidental. Now, just the latest victim among, you know, wrong way bets in the energy market, commodities, energy hedge funds, those are all in the red this year.
That was a clip from CNBC about Andy Hall, who was called the god of the oil and energy markets. And here we have him closing down his hedge fund. And it's amazing, too, because there was a recent article in the Wall Street Journal talking about OPEC is finally meeting with hedge funds because OPEC is scratching its head. It's like, hey, we're cutting production. Why isn't the price of oil rising like we expected? And that's OPEC's recognition of the hedge funds industry influence on the oil markets. And the result of that is recently is the head of Saudi Arabia is pushing OPEC towards new forms of compliance. And instead of monitoring, let's say, production cuts, the emphasis is now shifted towards exports. And that was a result of talking to hedge funds that are saying, hey, look, you guys are cutting production, but we watch what you're putting on tankers, and we haven't seen any cutback in tankers. And let's go to that clip that talks about the influence that the hedge fund market is having on the oil markets, to the point where you've actually got OPEC and Saudi Arabia consulting with hedge funds why the price of oil was dropping.
There's been increased evidence of how much the hedge funds are driving the markets. If we go back only a week, we see that in the week leading up to March the 14th, hedge funds pulled down their long exposure by a record amount, by over 153 million barrels in 1 week, which is a tremendous amount when we're talking about 900 million was the peak at the end of February. So really affecting the markets. And I think further evidence of that is the fact that the OPEC Secretary General recently met with a lot of leading hedge fund bosses to talk through. Hitherto, OPEC has really denounced speculators and tried to avoid them and discredit them, but now they're really seeking to engage them because they're having such an impact on the market.
Yeah, and what you heard here is instead of chastising them, they're actually listening, saying, why aren't the prices going down?
And the hedge funds are smart. They were looking at what was going on, even though there were production cuts within OPEC. What they were watching is, and something we watch, is tanker traffic. Because if you're cutting production, then you should see tanker traffic also slow down. But if the same amount of tanker traffic is traveling across oceans, where's the cut, guys? And so now exports have now become the new sort of criteria that everybody is monitoring in addition to inventories. And it's no secret that Saudi Arabia, after listening to these hedge funds, cut its exports to the U.S. Saudi Arabian exports have fallen from 7 million barrels a day down to roughly 6.5 million barrels a day. And they're also pushing within OPEC. They're trying to get other OPEC members and say, hey, guys, you know, selling from inventories is not cutting production because we're still pushing out oil out the door and we need the price of oil to rise. So exports have become now the key metric of monitoring the oil market for the financial markets. And finally, and this is sort of anecdotal evidence of bearish sentiment, but the front cover of The Economist, the bellwether of consensus thinking in the industry, declared the death of the combustion engine. And it's no secret, many people heard recently that Volvo, for example, by the year 2020 is going to stop making gasoline cars. You're seeing more hybrids. I know I drive an electric hybrid, and you're seeing, at least here in California, you see electric hybrids all over the place. And I don't know if you have them where you are, John, but when you pull into hotels now, and even some of the parking lots at shopping centers, they have charging stations for electric cars.
We have at least one place at the Golden Corral restaurant where they have them, but they're not very widely used right now. I kind of keep an eye on that.
Yeah, maybe this is just in larger states or places like California, but boy, we're seeing them in shopping centers here. We're seeing them in hotels. So, but you know, if you take a look at the oil market, summing up sentiment in the oil sector is it's bearish, maybe rising to neutral, which is what you want to see for a turnaround in the energy sector.
The bottom line here is that oil has bottomed, and that's due to a whole series of factors. Economies are picking up, which of course always increases demand as the economies kick up. They need more energy to satisfy that. U.S. dollar's fallen by 10%, and remember that oil is priced in dollars, so that does affect the price of it. Capital spending by oil companies has dropped dramatically, and that affects future production. And at the very same time, supply and demand is beginning to come back into balance. The IEA is reporting that global demand is increasing, and they have just increased their projections for demand this year. And then the sentiment, both by institutional and individual investors, largely hedge fund, is extremely bearish right now. So given this, what do you do?
Well, hopefully, if we're right, you were smart enough to pick up some of these oil stocks. I mean, I was like a kid in a candy store. When you can buy high-quality companies in the energy sector and get dividends in the range of 4 to 6% or more, you know, John, this is the cheapest that we've seen the energy sector going back to the beginning of 2016 when oil prices dropped down to $26 a barrel. So hopefully, we've seen this turnaround that we've seen. I don't care if you're looking at XLE, if you're looking at any of the oil stocks, we're seeing an upturn. So if oil continues, and remember, there's an incentive. Now OPEC is talking about extending their production cuts beyond the first quarter of next year, because I think it's probably going to take later into 2018 before we see these things come completely into balance. And oil should be telling us about that well in advance. In fact, there's rumors that Saudi Arabia is even postponing its IPO of Aramco to 2019. They want to see oil prices get up to $60 a barrel. So what are we going to need to do that? We're going to need to see OPEC in compliance, extend those cuts, and especially carry it over into exports, not just cut production, because you can sell from inventory and accomplish the same thing. You want to see demand continue with the economy, because if the economy was to go into recession, let's just say the Fed got aggressive and threw the economy into recession, of course, that would spoil that. You're also going to want to see a continued trend with a reduction in CapEx spending, a continued trend with the dollar continuing to go down. All of this is going to be supportive for energy inflation and the reflation trade that we think we're going to see coming up here in the fourth quarter.
Let's circle it back around to the question that we asked at the beginning of this whole segment, facing the economy anyway. Are we looking at a two-minute warning before things change, or are there really factors out there that could put us into overtime and keep this whole thing going?
I mean, there are a number of things that could either put us in the final stages or actually extend this economic recovery and bull market into overtime. And a lot of that's going to depend on two factors, John, the Fed and Washington and tax cuts. And I'm going to spend some time here on tax cuts. Now, the Fed has talked about a 2% inflation target, which we have not seen this business recovery. Now, the Fed is relying on its favored and I think flawed economic indicator for inflation, the Phillips curve, which states as inflation edges lower, you get high unemployment. And if it edges higher, then you get lower unemployment. So the trend has been inflation has ratcheted down after every recession since 1982. In fact, since 2009, inflation has fallen short of the Fed's 2% inflation projections. One of the issues I think that is not being addressed here is we're looking for inflation in all the wrong places. Where you really find inflation today, it's taking place in everything that is touched, and it's mainly in the government sector, especially things like healthcare, where we saw double-digit increases in healthcare premiums. If you're talking about Obamacare, premiums went up on average 25% this year. And if they don't fix it, and this is really going to become a political issue in 2018, you could see basically Obamacare premiums go up by 25 to 30% for the year 2018. I mean, it's surprising that McCain voted against it since premiums in Arizona are up 116% this year. So you're seeing inflation, but you're seeing inflation in sectors controlled by the government. Healthcare, one of them, education, still seeing high single-digit increases in education costs. You're seeing it in tax increases. California just increased taxes $52 billion. If you drive an electric car, you just saw a $100 premium added to your vehicle fees that you'll pay in addition to your regular vehicle fees for owning a electric car. The state of California just increased gasoline 20 cents. And it's amazing because I had family visiting from Arizona for the summer and they couldn't believe the price that they were paying for gasoline in California. Of course, that 20 cent increase. California also increased the cost of smoking. They added $2 tax to an 89 cent tax to a pack of cigarettes. And they also added $2 to a price of a cigar. And that's why I don't buy my cigars in California, because they're ridiculously priced. So these kind of things, John, are the kind of things that you see. Property taxes, fees, all kinds of things that governments are doing that aren't properly measured in the cost of inflation. So if you look at the regular inflation rates, we haven't hit the 2%. But if you look at any sector of the economy that is touched by government, you are seeing inflation.
So if you look at the regular inflation rate, why has the Fed not been able to hit its goal of 2%?
I mean, there's a number of explanations that have been given for this. Number one, the economy is really not at full employment because government statistics do not fully count all the unemployed people in the economy. Number two is Yellen's theory is that a lot of these price drops, whether it's been the drop in cell phone plans, prescription drugs, or the impact of online retailing, are kind of one-time events. Well, I hate to tell Yellen, but online retailing is not a one-time event. That continues as online sales continue to outpace brick-and-mortar sales. And number three, inflation is dropping due to other factors like technology and the efficiencies of scale that you get into with large-scale production. I mean, just take a look at what has happened with technology bringing down the cost of most of the things that we like to buy. I mean, even iPads have come down in cost, and Apple makes very popular products. Now, they're high-end products. They still charge a premium, but I mean, an iPad is $329. A couple of years ago, it was $499. The cost of a 4K TV or LED TV has come down tremendously. Blu-ray 4K players have come down. So technology is bringing down cost, and watch what happens with the Amazon effect with grocery stores now that Amazon owns Whole Foods. And you're also seeing things like Blue Apron, Green Chef bring down the cost of preparing meals. I mean, I use Green Chef and I can prepare dinner at a cost of $10 all organically. There's no way I could go to the store and buy those same ingredients for the same prices. So this raises the possibility of something we may see, which is the economic recovery could go into overtime, especially if the Fed becomes less aggressive in terms of raising interest rates. And number two, we get a tax increase, because if Yellen believes that lower inflation reflects trends rather than noise, then prepare for interest rates to remain lower for a lot longer, even though we've seen this jump in the Fed funds rate. Remember last Friday, we were looking at a 28% probability of the Fed raising interest rates in December. That jumped over 50% this week with the increase in the CPI numbers. So that's one of the reasons why we think one of the big surprises going forward here could be inflation rising in the fourth quarter due to the factors I cited about commodities going forward, the falling dollar, and the other things we've been talking about. So we've got one thing that's negative and positive. It depends on which way the Fed leans. If central banks are removing some of the monetary tailwinds, and we're seeing that happen, we saw it with the Bank of Canada this week. We saw it with the Bank of England saying, hey, we may be next joining the crowd. And we're also seeing it come from the ECB announcing that they may be talking about taper. So right now, we're seeing oil rise. We're seeing the dollar fall. And inflation is beginning to heat up in the ISM prices paid components. We're also seeing it heat up in import prices. Now, if they tighten in December and start shrinking their balance sheet, then we could be moving closer towards the 2-minute warning period if they do that. Otherwise, we could go into overtime. Now, there is one final extender that could put us into overtime, and this is a big one. And I want to cover tax policy, because that's all you're hearing talked about on television, because I think the Republicans know if they don't get this done, they are sunk when it comes to next year's election. The president wants to get this going because he knows that if this doesn't happen, that, you know, this was a big promise of his, middle class tax cuts. He wants to cut taxes for businesses in order to bring back jobs. And also, it's a big tax money raiser. If they can put in a special one-time tax on that $2.5 trillion of overseas profits, that could bring in $100 billion of tax revenues. So governments around the globe have been slashing corporate tax rates, pushing them further below the rate of the U.S. So the U.S. now has the distinction of having the highest corporate tax rates in the world. Just take a look at what has happened in the last 17 years. Since the year 2000, corporate tax rates have fallen globally from around 32% to below 25%. You compare that to the U.S., which is at 35%, and that's why a lot of people believe that a cut in corporate taxes is coming. That's something Republicans and Democrats can agree on. Now, whether it's 15%, which the president wants, or it ends up being a compromise somewhere between 20 or 25% with the rest of the globe, remains to be seen. But if they do cut that, look for also a one-time special cut in repatriating profits, which could come back and help either increase dividends, buybacks, or corporate CapEx spending, that $2.5 trillion that remains overseas. And I've heard talk of maybe dropping the tax rate, one-time tax rate, to 10%. So lowering taxes would do two things. That would extend the economic expansion, because there's no other policy the government can enact immediately that would put dollars into individual pocketbooks as well as businesses. They cut your tax rates. That means your paycheck, your take-home pay goes up. If they cut corporate taxes, that means corporation profits go up, which helps the stock market and helps corporate spending.
Well, and the real question is, how promising is this whole thing going to be? It's looking a little promising. You know, a lot of times they talk about tax reform and they tinker here and switch a few things around there. But here's Senator Toomey on tax cuts.
So I think we are gradually coalescing towards a consensus about what this tax reform is going to look like. And then the world will see a series of milestones along the way legislatively to determine whether or not we're actually getting the job done. I'm pretty optimistic. I think we're going to get a really good pro-growth tax reform bill done.
Do you need to get a budget resolution in place before you can really do tax reform?
Okay, that was Republican Senator Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, and this cut comes from Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs, U.S. Treasury, Tony Saig.
Senator Orrin Hatch is talking about a 20% corporate tax rate. The president wants 15%. Secretary Mnuchin, I think, wants 15%. Right. Gary Cohn wants 15%. Can you get it?
Look, we think 15% is the most pro-growth number that's going to make America number one in competitiveness as far as our tax rate around the world. We've been at 35%, while most of our trading counterparts have been in 15 to 20%. So clearly our goal is 15. We need to get it at the most competitive rate.
So the real question here is, number one, do they pass the tax cut? And two, even if they do pass the tax cut, is it worthwhile or is it just kind of a sham?
Well, right now, it's the top agenda for the Republicans this year because they failed to repeal Obamacare. If they can't get tax cuts through, John, they're finished when it comes to the 2018 election. So that is a top priority. And there is agreement, both Republicans and Democrats, that they need to do something on the corporate tax rates, because obviously if the corporate tax rates globally among our competitors in the large industrialized nations is under 25%, and we're at 35, and they're sitting on $2.5 trillion of profits overseas, even Democrats realize, hey, we need to do something to be more competitive here. So tax cuts are probably the most stimulative thing that governments can do. It's more effective than monetary policy. In a recent poll done with the NFIB and other business leaders, is business leaders prefer tax cuts because they're real. It puts money in their pockets. If you're a business and your tax rate goes from 35% to 20% or 15%, whatever it ends up being, that's more dollars in your pocket. You can spend that on CapEx spending. You can increase your dividends. You can expand. You can buy other companies. There's a number of things you can do. The one thing that tax cuts do that no other government policy does, it actually does put money in the pocketbooks of business and consumers. So, John, if this happens this year, the economy could go into overtime.
Okay, let's make an assumption here. Let's assume that the tax cut goes through. How is this going to play out then in the investment sector? Because if companies have lower tax rates, you can see the whole implication here.
Well, I mean, if we take a look at this, whether we're looking at a recession or a bear market, market tops are a process. They are brought about in end by a Fed rate raising cycle, which has preceded every recession. So as the Fed keeps raising rates, it leads to recessions and bear markets. So obviously, if they can cut taxes, that helps corporate earnings, that helps the stock market. Tax cuts put dollars into people's pocketbooks, and they have money to spend just like businesses. So that could extend the economic recovery, and along with it, it could extend the bull market in stocks. But if we start to see inflation start to rise as we expect, then the Fed is going to continue to raise interest rates. And we all know what eventually happens. They will keep raising them until they break something. And usually it's the economy and the stock market. So currently we are in a Fed and soon to be a global rate raising cycle, with Canada raising interest rates. England says they could be next, and the ECB will be joining the process with their tapering. But this process is taking place currently in a low inflationary environment. It's not like we're seeing inflation spiking as we did in the last decade, which was driven a lot by the spike in oil prices. Remember, from 2005 to the summer of 2008, the price of oil went from $50 to $150 a barrel. And the Fed funds rate went from 1% to 5%. I don't think you're going to see anything close to that this time around. But if we follow the pattern of past cycles, the first thing that you should see is bonds top out first. And we've already seen that. We're seeing it in the rise in the shape of the yield curve. We're seeing that in the low of 1.3% reached in the summer of last year. The second thing to play out would be stocks, would be the second asset class to peak. And I would look for seeing a change in leadership to go from not just technology, but also it would go to raw materials. So you see commodities start to rise. They become the top asset performing class. And then finally, as we get closer to the end, inflation is picking up. Commodities would be the last asset class to peak. We saw that in the lead up between 1999 and the year 2000, with bonds peaking in 1998, stocks peaking in March of 2000, and commodities peaking in the fall of 2000. Fast forward to the next recession and bear market. We saw bonds peak in 2006, stocks peak in 2007, and commodities peak in the summer of 2008. So those are sort of the sequence of events. If this plays out, it could be an extended play out because we're not really looking at the same levels of inflation, which were driven by economies that were growing. You got to remember, in the last decade, China's economy was growing at 12 to 14% a year. The emerging market economies were growing at 8 to 10% a year. We're nowhere close to that. And then we saw the price of oil triple from 50 to 150. This time around, we're lucky if we get to $60 a barrel, because at $60 a barrel, you're going to see American shale kick into full steam, and that would put a top in the short term to the price of oil.
So as we are staring either at a 2-minute warning or overtime, and this plays out in the investment cycle, what are you watching?
Well, we're going to watch for an increase in commodities to take the market lead. And along those lines, we're watching the price of oil, gold, and copper to confirm, along with base metals and ags. So if the reflation trade takes place, we're going to see that take place in commodities, and especially we're watching oil. If that happens, the second thing we're going to be watching is inflation levels should begin to increase. And along with that, that would give the Fed the ammunition to tighten its balance sheet. Now, if the Fed does that and we do not get tax cuts, then we are in the 2-minute warning period. But if they do push through tax cuts, then we go into overtime, which that is, I think, some of the key things that you want to watch as we head into the final months of this year. If we do get tax cuts, you could see the markets melt up towards the end of the year, because that would immediately impact corporate profits. I mean, that could increase corporate profits substantially. So that would be good news for the market. And if the Fed does go slow on raising interest rates, in other words, they say, okay, we're seeing the price of oil going up, but we haven't hit our inflation target yet of 2%, so we're not going to be as aggressive. If you see a little bit more dovishness coming from the Fed, even though they might raise rates in December, that would also lead to a market melt-up and also lead to an overtime extension, both in the economy and in the stock market. So those are the key things we're going to be watching going forward.
And Jim, all of these topics we've discussed today, looking at where we are in the economic cycle, you have an investment strategy seminar coming up. Why don't you give people some details on that, where I'm sure you'll address a lot of these topics as well.
Yeah, we're going to go into quite a bit of detail on what we think is going to take place in the fourth quarter and going into 2018, the reflation trade. We're going to talk about oil, the business cycle, an unusual time, and some of the things that we talked about in this hour of how this business recovery and bull market has played out differently than ones in the past. So how do you know whether we're getting to the 2-minute warning or we're going to go into overtime? We're going to address this rather extensively. We're going to talk about the rotation that we think is going to take place beginning in the fourth quarter. We're seeing some of that take place now. We're going to talk about wealth preservation strategies, especially when it comes to family businesses and real estate, and also wealth preservation strategies, how to protect yourself if any of these things unfold. It's probably one of the most comprehensive seminars that we have done, John, in years. And hopefully, if you have a lot of money invested in the market, you're going to want to attend this, because as you get to the end of the business cycle, as we talk about on what's going on with people's pension plans, we had two bear markets in the last decade. If you're in your 50s or in your 60s and getting close to retirement, Do you really want to go through another one? And these are some of the topics, John, we're going to cover in detail in our upcoming strategy, which will be held in San Diego on October 21st. It's an all-day event covering breakfast and a lunch in a Q&A session that will follow as we cover these topics of how we think this is going to play out this year and next year.
And going forward, what are we watching over the next couple of weeks here on the program?
Well, and the next thing coming up, we're going to be looking at corporate earnings because we'll be ending the third quarter here. And so that's going to lead to a number of things. We also have a Fed meeting coming up. So we're looking for confirmation. Is the Fed kind of pulling back from its kind of like hell's bells and full steam ahead? Are they going to stick with that theme? Or are they going to couch in a little nuances and say, well, we're still heading in that direction, but we may be a little bit slower. So we're going to watch the September FOMC meeting for any clarity in terms of what they're going to do in contracting their balance sheet and interest rates. We're going to be watching corporate earnings. Should Q3 come in as strong as the first two quarters of the year? We're also going to be watching oil prices as we head into the fall. Now, we're entering into the shoulder months of the year when the weather gets better and there's less energy consumption. So watch the things that we are talking about driving prices of oil higher. Watch the dollar. Watch the inventory levels. Watch CapEx spending. And also watch what's happening to demand and inventory levels. Do they continue to decline? We've seen a flattening in the rig counts. And then, of course, when we get into the month of October, John, we're going to be looking at a whole slew of economic numbers. Do we maintain with the strong economic growth into the third quarter of the year as we saw an increase in the second quarter? All of those things will determine the final outcome going into the latter part of this year in terms of what happens to the stock market and interest rates along the way. All of that, we'll be here to talk about it, as we hope you will. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on this special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.